It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Now, in a little bit, I'm going to play for you an interview I did earlier this week with documentary filmmaker Robert Muggy, whose documentaries Saxophone Colossus about Sonny Rollins, as well as The Gospel According to Al Green, are getting a reissue on home video and video on demand. So he lives up in Muncie and just did a 4-year residency at my alma mater at Ball State. And then we'll have enough time at the end to replay my chat with property brother Jonathan Scott, because he and his brother Drew are going to be part of the Scott Brothers House Party Tour, which is going to be stopping at the Murat in Indy on September 12th. But first, I want to start with a film that is getting a lot of notice here in the state because it was shot inside the state. The film Columbus, shot in Columbus, Indiana, tells the story of a Korean American who finds himself stuck in Columbus while his architect father is in a coma. Yeah, I'm reading off IMDb. But John Cho plays the gentleman stuck in small town America, and he meets a young lady played by Haley Lou Richardson, also stuck in her small hometown, dealing with her mother who's in recovery. And we have a story on paper could have a feel like Lost in Translation, or on paper, a romantic comedy. Just two lost souls stuck in a, and I'm not going to do the lyrics, but you have these two souls who need each other. It's Parker Posey is also in the film, Rory Culkin, and it has been said quite often that a location is a character in the film itself, and that's definitely the case with Columbus. Hope I'm saying that. Kogo Nada, the director and writer of the film, loves the city and loves to film the architecture. And there's a small dialogue plot point about the architecture of Columbus, Indiana. But it is it's a beautiful travelogue for the city at the very least. This film is not a romantic comedy and does not have a rom-com feel at all. It just has these two underplayed performances. Now, I know I've talked to some colleagues that think it's low energy and that is a deterrent. I think the fact that it's a low-key, underplayed film altogether, that because I think certain audiences are used to a heightened rom-com type feel, even though this is not a rom-com. I mean, even the big argument, the obligatory argument that happens between man and woman is underplayed. And there are character moments, or as I say, there are character things and plot things that you are familiar with, but it's underplayed. I don't think it's low energy. I just think it's a subtle film. So the fact that it's getting some notice, especially when you have a couple of known actors like John Cho, like Haley Lou Richardson, Parker Posey is also in the film, and hopefully this will get a wider release. Obviously, it's a wider release, not just here in Indiana, but outside of Indiana. So, a low key story about two people needing to move on with their lives and find out it's not that easy. Now, also in theaters is a film called Unlocked, a political thriller that it's part fugitive, part a Bourne film with less editing, and a climax that almost has a biochemical Black Sunday feel to it. Really good cast. You have Rooney Mara, who is was a member of the CIA, is brought back in as an interrogator, as you've heard many times before in the trailers, things are not as they seem, and she winds up being on the run. Along the way, she runs into, literally and figuratively, the likes of Toni Collette, John Malkovich, Michael Douglas, Orlando Bloom as a Cockney thief, and as we find out, a former soldier. It's directed by Michael Apted, and of course, best known for the Up film series as far as documentaries, and he's done other things for years and years, Coal Miner's Daughter, Nell. But the feature film portion of Apted's career in the last decade or so, not particularly memorable. He did do The World Is Not Enough, the Bond film, yes, the one with Denise Richards, but films like Enigma, Enough, Amazing Grace, Chasing Mavericks, not really mind-blowing cinema. Especially compared to his Up series. And this is a film that if you've seen a political thriller or an action film or a Bourne film, you know plot points are coming. In fact, there's a few moments, the way that the film is shot, that you'll see something early on and you'll be able to, you could guess what's going to happen near the end. Some scenery chewing monologue near the end as well. There are certain name actors who are in the show. It looks like they have very little to do, if anything, and there's going to be a payoff for that actor near the end, but not really a surprise for the audience. So really good people. Hope they get to work together again in some other film. It said this one's really predictable, and that's a bummer. Okay. Going into the video store briefly, you have the film My Cousin Rachel, and then the big title is the film version of Baywatch with Dwayne Johnson and Zac Efron, and it's a film that wanted to be like 21 Jump Street, just not funny enough, not even close. And, yeah, that's about it. Okay, moving over to the Tibbs Drive-In, we have on screen one, The Hitman's Bodyguard and Annabelle Creation. Screen 2, Birth of the Dragon and Girls Trip. Screen 3, Logan Lucky and Kidnap. Screen 4, Leap and The Nut Job 2. Over at the Skyline for the weekend, The Nut Job 2, Spider-Man Homecoming, and Atomic Blonde. Over at IU Cinema the next event, because it's the holiday weekend, Tuesday, September 5th, the documentary The 800 Mile Wall at 7 o'clock. Thursday, the 7th, the 2015 documentary Bikes vs. Cars. Friday, the 8th, The World of William Wegman, a shorts program at 6:30 p.m. Endless Poetry at 9 p.m. And the Midnight Movie Series on Friday, September 8th. Oh, The Holy Mountain from 1973. And then Saturday the 9th, the Cafe Walduf at 7 p.m. On Sunday, September 10th at 3 p.m., 1964's Beckett with Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole. Endless Poetry at 6:30 p.m. And should also mention Monday, September 11th is a part of the East Asian film series Tharlo at 7 o'clock. And Thursday, September 14th. At 7 p.m., Le Samurai. Don't miss that one. And there will be a screening of Columbus, the second screening added on Friday, September 15th. Okay, I want to get to Dead People We Like because we don't have time for Dead People We Don't Like. Filmmaker Toby Hooper passed away on August 26th at the age of 74. Obviously, his first film was a short called The Heisters, and in 1969 there was Eggshells, and then he set the world ablaze in 1974 with The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, a film that helped change horror cinema and lead us down the horror path that we saw throughout the 1970s. And follow that up with Eaten Alive, which is kind of underrated. One of the more scarier TV movies from 1979, he did the film version of Stephen King's Salem's Lot. The Funhouse, again, not even close to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And then he did Poltergeist, and yes, you can talk about how much of it was shot by him, how much of it was done by Steven Spielberg. But it did lead him to doing a couple more studio pictures like Invaders from Mars and everybody's favorite naked vampire space movie, Life Force. He also did the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Nobody quite got the humor on that one. The underrated Spontaneous Combustion from 1990, Night Terrors, The Mangler from 1995, and a remake of The Toolbox Murders from 2004. His impact duly noted. And actor Richard Anderson passed away on August 31st at the age of 91. Best known, as of course, on TV as Oscar Goldman from The $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman. Film credits go all the way back to 1947, but also appeared in such noted films as Forbidden Planet, The Buster Keaton Story, Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory, The Long Hot Summer, The Wackiest Ship in the Army, Johnny Cool, 7 Days in May, Kitten with a Whip, yes, the one with Anne Margaret, the Rock Hudson film Seconds, Tora, 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 Doctor's Wives, and then did a slew of television from the 60s on. So salute to both of those gentlemen. Okay, I want to get to now my interview with documentary filmmaker Robert Muggy, whose Sonny Rollins documentary, Saxophone Colossus, as well as The Gospel According to Al Green, have been reissued on video and video on demand. Here's my chat with Robert Muggy. Well, Robert, I want to start with, first off, I'd say, looking at your body of work, and it was very influential for me getting started in music journalism. The documentaries, and I mean, you've covered people on music that I've been listening to for a couple of decades. So your work has become
very good taste.
Well, you know, great minds think alike, or at least look up each other's work. But I really, between stuff like Memphis Blues and what we're going to talk about a little bit, blues divas, even the Gospel According to Al Green. These have been sought after, and fortunately in the 21st century, a lot of these, especially older titles, are becoming more and more available if you look for them.
Yes, I've really been thrilled the last, I guess, about 2.5 years now. A company called MVD Visual, which is part of MVT Entertainment Group, has been just gradually releasing or re-releasing, I guess it's about 2/3 of my work now. They've put out sometimes a Blu-ray or DVD will combine a couple of my films, a few cases, but mostly they've been individual with bonus features. But they've released 22 of my films over the last couple of years out of the something like 35 I've done. And it looks like I'm finally about to get Mississippi Public Broadcasting, for whom I made Blues Divas, which you mentioned, back in 2004, 2005 with Morgan Freeman and a whole bunch of amazing female blues, R&B, folk artists. They're finally about to agree to let MVD and me release the two-hour film as well as 8 separate long-form portraits for the 8 women that I created at that time. So, but as you know, I'm sure the most recently released are Saxophone Colossus with Sonny Rollins and Gospel According to Al Green, both of which are among those I've remastered for MVD, which is one of the best parts of it, that I'm getting to get the films back out there totally remastered for HD and everything.
It's been a great renaissance for you. Do you own copies of all of your work? And you know, as far as getting cleaned up copies, as you mentioned, for remastering?
I own the rights to most of them, not all of them. Like Dave Stewart of Eurythmics owns Deep Blues, and which is, in many ways, probably the most influential film I've made. And he and I have been in conversation for a few months now about what he calls relaunching that film. He wants me to remaster it, and he wants to bring it back for some theatrical screenings, for home video, for television, for whatever we can do. He just did a major move from Los Angeles to Nashville, so he's been a little distracted. But as soon as he comes up for air and decides which companies he wants to get behind it, we're going to start working on that too. So, yeah, the only downside for this is I have put over the last couple of years so much work into all the remastering, because I supervise or do everything myself. I supervise the new transfers from film to video. I do all the color correction of myself, very painstakingly, slowly on my computer. And we did 4K transfers for the Al Green and Sonny Rollins films. The previous ones have been 2K, but it means even more work. And then I supervise the authoring, the package design for the Blu-ray and or DVD releases, press releases. Mm-hmm. It's been a lot of work, and so it's meant less filmmaking as a result. But I just figure this is such a major investment in the future to make sure that the best possible versions of as many of these films as possible are out there. And in the near future, there are some that are owned by other people, and we're going to approach some of those owners and see if they'll let us, you know, take a stab at those films as well. For instance, my film Hellhounds on My Trail, The Afterlife, mm-hmm. Robert Johnson, they would own the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum is where the majority of that was shot, and they would only permit the film if they were the ultimate owner of it. So I've got to go back and work things out with that, but that'll probably be on our list for the very near future too.
Well, that takes out my last question on this list. What are you currently working on now? So, but that's okay. Yeah. That's fine.
I came to Indiana because 8 years ago for a 5-year position as endowed chair of telecommunications at Ball State teaching filmmaking. And when I got there, that ended 3 years ago, but my wife and I have, for the moment, stuck in Indiana, in Muncie, where we live now. But one of the people I met when I got here was Steve Bell, mm-hmm. the great ABC, retired ABC News national and international correspondent, the original news anchor for Good Morning America for its first 11 years, but who after he retired from the news business, came to Ball State as its first endowed chair for telecommunications. So I used to go to these parties with Steve where he'd go on and on about these incredible stories about, you know, being there for Bobby Kennedy's assassination, being there just after John F. Kennedy's assassination, Martin Luther King's assassination, Watergate, being captured by the Viet Cong when he was covering Vietnam and Cambodia, the wars, covering the POWs, Mideast peace, just a million amazing stories, and all of which have footage to cover them at ABC. So one of the last things I did while I was at Ball State was to do a 4.5-hour oral history so that he could lay out 100 of his stories. And then after leaving Ball State, I cut together an initial cut of a 2-hour documentary using his own personal copies of a lot of the ABC news footage. But I haven't been able to complete it yet because we need $100,000 just to pay ABC for the rights to the news footage and to good copies of it. So that's one of the things I'm completing now. There's other things in the works, which I probably shouldn't jinx by by talking too much about them. But But yeah, I'm still sort of finishing up this sort of re-release of his remastering and re-release of as much of the early material as possible. Really, so happy to be doing that. It's a real blessing to be able to do it, because you know the internet, for all the wonderful things it's done, it's basically helped kill book publishing and the music business and the home video business. Mm-hmm. So I was really grateful when Ed Seaman from MVD got in touch with me almost 3 years ago now and said, you know, we should work together. And so we just kind of put together a partnership for the release of all these things.
And you can tell Steve Bell never got footage of Sonny Rollins breaking his foot. So, you know, you got that on him.
No, and I don't usually think of my films as journalism, but you could almost say there's, although the Steve Bell film is all about journalism and how journalism has changed since the days, broadcast journalism, how it's changed since the days when he was working for national and international ABC News. But certainly it's almost a journalistic thing to be there when something like his jumping off of a 6-foot outdoor stage onto the rock surface below, breaking his heel, falling onto his back, lying there for a moment, holding the saxophone above him with his eyes closed, and then suddenly starting to play again. Where that's concerned, that I suppose is almost journalistic coverage. But just the whole thing, you know, in documentary filmmaking is you want to be as prepared as possible. You want to be ready with as much structure as possible, but you always want to be ready for what happens, for what the universe gives you. And that was a rather rare moment, which people can see if they buy the new Blu-ray or DVD of Saxophone Colossus, the MVD release of it.
Yeah, I was interested in how easy or difficult was it to get Sonny to be a part of this? And one of the things I've read in a few write-ups is that he is labeled by some journalists as difficult. How was it for you to get this project off the ground?
Well, you know, I was incredibly fortunate, because you're right that I wouldn't call him difficult, but I'd call him reticent.
Okay.
I'd call him, you know, he hasn't been able to play the last few years because of a medical condition. And, you know, he's well into his 80s, everything as well. But, you know, he had obsessively for decades, you know, worked on his strength every day, worked on his playing many hours every day, delved into various sort of spiritual and metaphysical areas to just as means towards his artistic end. And so he really, to some extent, he just didn't want to be bothered with outside projects or an excessive number of interviews or anything. But I was very fortunate, because in early 1986, I was looking for my next film subject. And one of the things I had been thinking about would, you know, doing something on the whole idea of improvisation, because, you know, on top of everything else with each of these films, I learned something. I try to go cover subjects that I want to know more about. And, I'm sorry. Are you hearing that?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm sorry. I guess that's a call trying to come through.
That's okay.
I hope you can cut this out.
I'll work on it.
Okay. But anyway, my jazz critic friend, Francis Davis, in Philadelphia, in early 1986, told me how he had just had this wonderful interview experience with Sonny Rollins and his wife and manager, Lucille Rollins. And he said it was really enlightening, because he said a lot of people had told him how difficult Lucille was. And that's what always happens when an artist doesn't want to do a lot of press, doesn't want to do a lot of extra projects and stuff. It's the gatekeeper, you know, usually a manager, sometimes a spouse, whatever, who is made to appear to be the bad guy, as it were, and say no. But at this particular time, they were preparing this concerto for tenor sax and orchestra that Sonny had composed, commissioned by an orchestra called the Nippon Japanese orchestra owned
right.
by a gigantic newspaper over there, the biggest newspaper in the world, Yomiuri Shimbun. But he was preparing to do this orchestral piece that he was going to perform as part of. And his wife, Lucille, coincidentally felt like he was in the strongest, doing the strongest playing of his life. And she wanted that represented. She wanted that promoted. And so I asked, I found this out because Francis was kind enough to put me in touch with them. So there was not resistance. Plus, I had come off of a whole string of similar musical portraits, you know, Reuben Blades, Al mm-hmm. Green, Gil Scott-Heron, Sun Ra, as well as Cool Runnin's, the reggae movie, which I shot at Sunsplash in Jamaica. This was all over a several-year period from the late 70s into the mid-80s. The other reason I really wanted to follow through with what they were telling me was I'd always felt like we missed out by not having cameras the first time John Coltrane did A Love Supreme, the first time Duke Ellington did his Sacred concerts. You can come up with any number of examples from jazz history of times when great jazz artists decided they were going to try something different, something really ambitious. You know, those kinds of things where you get into the concert hall, where you even, you know, join up with symphony orchestras and all, are often controversial with hardcore jazz critics who think jazz artists should just be traditional jazz artists. But they often result in really interesting work. And I had no idea what this new piece of his was going to be like, but I felt like he was a great enough artist that it was worth the risk, and was thrilled when Britain's Channel 4 Television, which had funded three of my four previous films, agreed to put a chunk of the money into this one. And I was able to find some additional money elsewhere quickly enough that I was able to take a small crew to Japan for that. And then, as you say, I came back and did an ensemble concert at Opus 40, a sculpted rock garden that has a concert space in upstate New York, which is where he jumped off and ended up breaking his heel in the middle of the performance. So yeah, there's a lot of fun material in that film. It's hard to believe it's more than 30 years old now, but the playing is as fresh as ever, certainly. Mm-hmm.
What I like about the film, I'm a Rollins fan, and you got to capture two different aspects of his work, the two different settings, of course,
right.
and the styles. And I know for a lot of musicians, and Sonny talks about this, about music as meditation. Now, some artists can go for hours talking about it, and there are others, I'm guessing like Sonny, that do a little but not a lot. So what I was cool about this documentary is you let the music do the talking for the most part. It was not that your standard bio story, and we got a little, but I mean the big long chunks of performances are the crust of this documentary, and I think that speaks volumes for Sonny.
Yes, but he does, of course. Ironically, there open up the film by briefly talking about how he prepares, how he before a concert, how he it is like a meditation. He thinks about the pieces he's going to play, and much as like you know, it's on a whole other level. But much as I, as a filmmaker, you know, will research a subject to the point where I could probably make 10 different films about this subject, but then I just go out there and see what happens. He thinks about all these different ways that he could perform a piece, and then, but then he just goes out there and just lets the spirit move him. And then, of course, it goes right into that extraordinary piece, G-Man, which he was premiering that day, which, you know, ended up being on all sorts of, well, like Robert Christgau, for in his Paz and Jop report of, in, used to have in the Village Voice, you know, called it like the best music of that year, and then put it as, what was it, something like number five as among our soundtrack album, something like number five of the best albums of the 80s. So I think we did capture some pretty great music. The other thing about the concerto, lots of people love it. You know, it's still a little bit controversial with some hardcore jazz people, but sadly, he never followed through with his intentions to go into a studio and record it. As a result, this is going to be it, because he's finished playing. And it includes all but two movements. He asked me to leave two of the movements out because hearing them back, he didn't feel like they were as strong as they should have, been. And he was planning to rework them. He did do another two performances of the concerto later in Italy, but then that was it. So, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, one of the things we do is document. Mm-hmm. And is, you know, we try to tell stories, we try to explore themes, but on a certain level, we're just there to run film, run video, and try to capture things that we believe are worthy of capturing. And that was certainly what I was trying to do with those performances.
Well, mission accomplished on those. And I mean, it is still a timeless piece of filmmaking, along with the timeless piece of music. The only thing you can digitally remove are probably the 80s sweaters that the small ensemble wears. But other than that, I mean, this could have been shot today. Well, yeah.
Eyeglasses, yeah.
I
we did wear rather large eyeglasses and sunglasses back in the 80s. And yes, some of those clothes were a bit extreme as well.
Herbie Hancock doesn't know what you're talking about.
Sure, you're right.
No, I wanted to share with you. I have one Sonny Rollins story. I got to see Sonny with my now wife, 20 years ago, up at Ravinia in the Chicago area, and he did a 15-minute version of St. Thomas, which he has been known to do.
Yes, he is.
I was thoroughly impressed. My wife, who has an MFA and can sing, not so much. She felt there was no beginning, middle, and an end to his solos, but I was kind of in awe. I was a little fanboy about Sonny. Fast forward to Ken Burns's documentary series about the history of jazz, and somebody tells a story about how music is serious, you know, obviously it's meditation for Sonny. And if he's not feeling it, he will play something like St. Thomas for 20 to 25 minutes on a bad night. And I had to sit my wife down, play this for her, and then apologize that I took her to see Sonny Rollins on a bum night.
It could have also just been a difference of opinion, because he can also do a 20-minute St. Thomas or Don't Stop the Carnival or whatever that'll knock your socks off, as the saying used to go. So it can sometimes be in the ear of the beholder and everything, too. But it is true. He's known for having good nights and bad nights as a performer. And for a good while, he's one of the things that's discussed in the film is his, by mid-career, getting known for being far better in concert than on average than on the records, though they did, as Gary Giddens says in the film, jazz critic Gary Giddens, that once Sonny and Lucille started producing them themselves, the albums did on average get much better again. But we were sort of in the midst of, when I made the film, we were sort of in the midst of that period where there had been a bit of a lull. Some of the albums were less than extraordinary, but he just kept working like crazy, and the concerto and these other pieces are, I think, the result of that major effort he made mid-career, and just kept. I mean, when you think of how few artists work at that level their entire career, you know, but he just essentially never let up, right up through, you know, having his own label toward the end, and, you know, well, and still does, and they're still, you know, releasing other unheard performances and so forth now.
Yeah, it's fun that, you know, to this day, a certain faction of the country makes fun of aging rockers. And you know, there are blues and jazz guys who are in their 80s and 90s that are still playing, or at least still bringing out some form of output. And, you know, Sonny was one of those. And, you know, you'd like to see a 20-year-old blow saxophone like Sonny did.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he really was a force of nature out there. And that's sort of a longstanding true cliche that if you want a long-lasting, relevant career, you're better off going into jazz or blues. Of course, if you want to make a lot of money, there's at least the potential for that in rock music, even though only a handful really make it. Make that sort of money and everything. But yeah, and you know, you look at like my film Gospel According to Al Green, which we also just recently re-released, and of course Al had his traumatic after huge success in the early to mid 70s. You know, there was a 2-year period in the early 70s where only the Beatles and the Rolling Stones sold more records than he did. But, you know, he had these traumatic situations in his personal life, from being born again at Disneyland to this woman throwing hot grits on him and then allegedly shooting and killing herself, that pushed him back into the church. And, of course, so I came in. He started his church, right, that would have been 76,
yep,
because we came in for the 7th anniversary. That was the church service we filmed, which is just unbelievable, the music that he makes, the power of his performance. The word power isn't even anywhere near strong enough. But we came in late 1983 for that 7th anniversary. And so, you know, he's managed all these years to go on playing music that is timeless and not topical and all that, and 'cause he went more in the gospel direction, but he still, as you know, every so often he'll come out and do some kind of soul pop as well. I should just recommend a new book that's coming out on the 29th of August. It's called Soul Survivor, and it's a biography of Al Green, and it's pretty fascinating. I got an advanced copy because I was quoted a lot in the book, and so I'm reading it now and enjoying it.
I got to see Al Green at his church Super Bowl Sunday 2006, and an amazing service. And I knew he was this was at that phase where he would go and do his regular show on Friday or Saturday and then fly back to Memphis and be there for service. And it was interesting to see occasionally a few tourists that would kind of walk out maybe 20 minutes into his sermon when they realized he wasn't going to sing Let's Stay Together or or tired of being alone.
They really be idiots to think he's going to sing Let's Stay Together.
And he pointed this out as they were leaving. He's like, sorry, ladies, not today. and then, well, I'm sorry. And then I got to interview him when he for this station when he played at Indie Jazz Fest. And the question I got to ask him was, do you know how many children you have brought into the world with your music? And his response is, yeah, but now I'm baptizing him. And you know,
he brought a few of them into the world in other ways.
Yeah, exactly. And his show, I mean, and this was just a straight ahead show, and this was the only time I'd ever seen women in their 60s screaming like teenagers, like it was 1973 all over again.
Oh yeah, he probably brought out the roses.
Oh yeah, an armful. I mean, you know, people talk about Elvis and the scarves, but he would come out, you know, for every song with an arm full of roses.
Yeah. As you probably know, when I made that film, he had gone totally into the church, was refusing to do any of his former soul and pop hits, and so it was a real struggle for me to try to get him to do anything. And I did this long interview with him, and fortunately he sat there much of the time with a guitar, and he played little bits of a few of his better known songs. But I ended up having this theme develop around the idea of Let's Stay Together. It was especially important in the parts of the film involving producer Willie Mitchell, who had been responsible or heavily responsible for so much of Al's early success, but who had to part ways with him initially when Al decided he only wanted to do gospel music, because Willie wasn't interested in doing gospel music with him. He just wanted to keep doing R&B. So the only, I kept trying to, how am I going to get him to do Let's Stay Together? So I suggested to him that he do a, he kind of stage a rehearsal in his personal studio, and that, you know, this would give us another way, another situation in which he and his musicians could perform for us. And then after he'd done a whole series of the same gospel songs that, we were ultimately going to film him doing in concert anyway, at a concert we filmed in the Washington D.C. This was at his Memphis studio where we were staging this rehearsal. I just said, you know, Al, I just love that song, Let's Stay Together. Would it be possible just to play a little and let me hear it and everything? And he said, okay. And so in the film, you see him teaching the song to his female backup singers and all. And enough of the musicians had been with him for enough years that they were able to perform it. So we get this wonderful, complete version of Let's Stay Together, which is just so important to the film. But it was a struggle. And and then he made me crazy, because later at the theatrical premiere of the film, it was at the Coolidge Corner Movie House in Brookline, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. And he came up, he joined me for the opening night, and the film was being shown twice, and then he was to talk or perform afterwards. So we got him a guitar, and after both showings of the film, he got up and just did one hit after another that he had refused to do for the film. It really made me crazy, but it was an incredible night. Anyway, everybody who was there had quite a treat.
I bet. But, Robert, how did your music journey begin? What did you grow up listening to? Because looking at the subjects that you've interviewed over the years, I want you to come to my basement and look at my music collection. I'd like to do the same.
Well, I was born way back in 1950, and I was born in Chicago, but my father was doing his dissertation for the University of Chicago, his doctoral dissertation on black migration in the South. So we quickly moved to Atlanta. Then we moved to D.C. briefly. Then we moved to Raleigh, North Carolina when I was two, and we were there for the next 7 days, 7 years. And so, like, when I was four, which would have been 1954, I got my first radio. When I was in second grade, which would have been 1957, I started watching American Bandstand. So, like, on local radio, without knowing what I was hearing, I was hearing, you know, I was hearing black music, I was hearing country music, and I was hearing the beginnings of rock and roll. Then when I was nine, my father took a job with the federal government, which he had for the rest of his career, one part of the government or another. And so I was suddenly moving to a real black city, which is, we don't think of it as a southern city, but it still really is. You know, it's below the Mason-Dixon line, and it was the compromise on where the capital would be. They ended up putting it, you know, right between Maryland and Virginia and what was considered the South. So anyway, I grew up with lots of black music there, became a big soul music fan. And so as I was in my teens, I was going back and forth between, you know, like early rock and roll and then British Invasion and Dylan from very early on and soul music and you know, D.C. was a major hub for all sorts of other things, including bluegrass. And but at the same time, my father was a huge opera fan, so that whenever he was home, there was constantly opera or Baroque music or occasionally musical comedies playing in the house. So I was really immersed in music. And when I was in high school, I was in bands and I wrote a lot of music. I even wrote a musical comedy over the summer between my junior and senior high school years. So later, when I went to film school and then graduated from undergraduate film degree, just did 1 year of grad school because I was just too anxious to get out and make films. But then the question was always, okay, what are you going to make films about? And it bugged me at that time, seeing so many filmmakers doing films on filmmaking, which just seemed a little silly. And I had this other really great interest, which was music. And so my plan had always been to make feature films and do fun little music docs on the side. And the features kept not getting funded. But the music docs did, and they just kept getting bigger and bigger. And so I said, okay, this is what I guess I'm meant to do. And it's been fine. And there's still hopefully more to be made.
Yep. And as I say, the music world is all the better for it. And
well, thanks so much.
You bet. Documentary filmmaker Robert Muggy. His documentaries Saxophone Colossus about Sonny Rollins, as well as The Gospel According to Al Green, have been reissued on DVD, Blu-ray, I believe, and video on demand. But my God, Deep Sea Blues, Blues Divas, Last of the Mississippi Jukes, Hellhounds on My Trail, Deep Blues, Hawaiian Rainbow, Return of Reuben Blades, Cool Runnings, Black Wax, Sun Ra, Joyful Noise, Amateur Night at City Hall. Is that jazz? I mean, just go to his website and you should see more of his work because I said so. All right. The Scott Brothers House Party. That's September 12th at the Mirah. And a few years back, I got to do a chat with Jonathan Scott. Enjoy.
Hey, Matthew. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
Too bad.
Good. This is a film show here in Indianapolis. It's called Film Sociology on WFYI in Indianapolis. And the first thing everybody inside my building is asking, why am I talking to you? Or actually, why are you talking to me, I guess?
I heard that you're the guy that everyone wants to hang out with in Indianapolis.
Oh, you're
isn't that enough?
You're a better actor than you already are. No, I believe it's the King of the Castle home upgrade.
Yeah, it's the Dove Men Plus Care Hair King of the Castle Home Upgrade. Basically, it's a chance for me to go into one real man's house and totally upgrade and do what I would want to do. Some fun. We've got fun prizes that we're giving away and things like that. So it's going to be not just an opportunity for me to go and hang out with somebody at their home and consult on what we want to do, but we're going to deliver these incredible prizes too.
You mean you're going to get rid of the beer posters from 1983 off the walls?
Well, you know, it depends. It depends what it is. I went into my brother's place one time, my older brother, and he had the Kramer up on the wall. And, you know, I couldn't take it down. It had too many fond memories for me.
There are certain wall art that I guess develops character.
It does. It does.
So how can guys? And by the way, the ladies outside the window of the recording studio are waving at you. So let that be known.
Tell them that I'm waving back.
Oh, I will. So how can guys enter and get interested, and how can they get in touch with you about this?
The easiest way is to go to the dovemencare.com/kingofthecastle, and that's got all the details on it, or through social media as well. But the best thing is, you know, people want to get in right away, so they have the opportunity to get the application in. We're going to pick one real man across the country, and we're going to basically go in. We'll either do a real King of the Castle upgrade and put a moat into his home with a functioning drawbridge, or maybe we'll build the ultimate tree fort in the backyard so the kids have a strong place to play. Or it might even be something as well. We have authentic-looking British Royal Guards that will guard the house for a week and do a changing of the guard ceremony twice daily, things like that. So there's bizarre prizes, but all this stuff. It's going to be fun, and you know, we have things, too, like a home automation and home security system, as well as an outdoor kitchen and dining room area. So they have tons of prizes to choose from, but it's going to be an incredible experience.
I'm curious, what home improvement shops have beef eater guards?
Only the ones that I deal with, let me tell you.
And do they have the bottles with their images on them as well?
Well, this is what I'm thinking. I think if somebody comes in and they choose that prize, that, first of all, I think it's something that's going to be great for somebody to brag. You know, if you think about it, you know, a guy says to a girl, yeah, you know, come on over, you know, I've got this great place, check it out. And she walks up, and all of a sudden there's British Royal Guards there. She's going to think he's a king. So there's something going on. I think it's impressive. But if you're thinking longevity and the value of the home, then, you know, going with one of the other upgrades that we have that's hard value to the house, I think, is an amazing idea.
Now, are there themes like, you know, King of Thrones or Elsinore from Hamlet or Xanadu and Citizen Kane or even the Castle Anthrax from Holy Grail?
Matthew, where were you when we were doing the creative process here? These are the ideas that I need. And if I'm only relying on Drew to help me come up with ideas, I mean, we're going to fall flat.
So
I need you. I need you in my camp.
Brother Dig, minutes into the chat. That's great. So I guess, what other home improvement tips can one give you, especially if you're in the Midwest in the fall? There's simple things about having to call in the troops that folks can do around the house to make things better for the fall?
Yeah, there's a lot of maintenance that we say. You always want to do your maintenance in the fall just before you get into the winter, and then in the spring again before you have the warm weather come around and all, you know, depending on where you are, if there's snow melt off and stuff like that. But the biggest thing for going in the winter is, one, you want to make sure that your furnace is functioning the most efficiently that it can. So simply just changing out filters. You also want to make sure that you've got adequate insulation. So usually say, if you haven't blown in extra insulation into the attic, that's something that's very easy to have a company come in and do, or you can do it yourself too. And then walking around and just checking the entire house for any leaks around windows, air leaks around doors, making sure all the seals are good. That's the first thing that you can do. Something else that people don't realize that helps with the bills a little bit, you know, everyone uses their fans, their ceiling fans in the summertime. They like that cool air blowing down on them. But your ceiling fans, especially if you have tall ceilings, 10-foot ceilings or 12-foot ceilings, if you reverse them in the wintertime, they actually recirculate that hot air that's rising. They recirculate it back down to the lower areas. So you'll find that your heating bill is lower if you use your ceiling fan in reverse.
But the toilet swirling, that's a different story.
Yeah, if you want your toilet to swirl the other way, you've got to go to Australia.
Okay, that's good to know. So what is next for you television-wise?
Right now, first of all, I don't know what you expect of me. I already have 3 shows that we're doing full time. But slowly we're taking over the airwaves. We have some other exciting projects coming up in the new year. You're going to get to see inside my house for the first time. You'll see what I actually am doing. I'm doing a massive project on my house in Vegas. And that's going to be a lot of fun. My favorite spaces to do are outdoor living spaces,
mm-hmm.
which is why with the Dove Men Plus Care contest, I'm doing the treehouse out back, because I love doing outdoor spaces. It's a great way to entertain, a great way for the family to have a space so they don't have to always go out to a theme park or something. But you're going to see some pretty wild stuff there. And then a lot of other projects. You know, we're doing projects with, you know, companies like Funny or Die, and we're doing all these other digital vignettes online, so, you know, people can see those on hgtv.com and on our website, thestepbrothers.com.
Some of the ladies are already asking, why isn't your house like Game of Thrones? So I'm not going to – we'll just leave it at that. So now I have to –
I'll admit, my house, when it's done, it's going to be so much fun. We have everything from an infinity pool with a swim-up bar, a water slide going around a cluster of palm trees from the second story of the house, and a drive-in size movie screen that comes up on hydraulics. So if you guys are ever in Vegas, I expect that the whole station there, you're going to come in and you're going to visit.
Oh, those are fatal last words, my friend. and so, actually, by the way, in my house, this HDTV is a station my wife has on all the time when she's working. So I think you're spending a lot of time with the missus, and I need to talk to you about that.
You know, she sounds like a very smart lady with impeccable taste.
I call her sitcom wife, but then again, she makes fun of me when Candace and Genevieve are on, and I come screaming through the walls. So,
well, this is the funny thing. I laugh is when people say to me, and we'll come up, we'll do live lectures, and you know, the wife will come up, and the husband's right there, and she'll just say, "There's only one thing I want to fall asleep to in bed, and that's you." And I feel really awkward and uncomfortable. And the husband's like, "It's true. It's true. I shouldn't have put the TV in the bedroom."
This is a public station. We're not going to go there. Let's see. So, movie-wise, I guess, have you watched any movies lately? Do you get a chance to with three shows and all the stuff you got going on?
I do. I haven't seen as many movies lately as what I usually do, but I don't watch TV, really. So the only thing I like to do is sort of go and escape and do film. And, you know, I own a film production company as well.
Yeah, I would say, what's the word on that?
Yeah, we actually are gearing up for our first big feature film. We've done a lot of independent projects. I did a lot of short films when we were younger, but our first full-length feature we're aiming to shoot next year, and that'll be a romantic comedy, a lot of fun. But I did see recently, is it Captain Phillips?
Yes.
I saw that. I thought it was fantastic. Tom Hanks is one of my favorite actors, and the way he portrays it, he just did a really great job. It's intense. It gets pretty intense.
Yes, it does.
Boy, if you rattled off some films, you know, I saw some that were a little bit more controversial. I saw Don John. You know what? As long as you can get past the uncomfortable subject matter, I thought it was really well done. I thought it was hilarious.
It is a standard romantic comedy. It just happens to have a lot of online porn, that's all.
Yeah, isn't that the sign of a true romantic comedy, though? I don't know.
Yes, it is. And, you know, of course, some people will say if you're dating Scarlett Johansson and you're still going online, you're an idiot. But that's not for me to say. How much of the money pit is accurate, I guess, from your standpoint?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Interesting you say that, because I have come across some projects where it almost becomes comical how many problems we come across. And anytime it's a property like that, it was usually a previous owner was intentionally hiding the problems to pull the wool over your eyes, and I hate that. I think it's, you know, it's just a terrible thing to do. So I always say, if you come across a problem with your home, you fix it. You don't pass the buck on to somebody else. This is your home. This is your asset. You're responsible for it. Whenever we're doing a construction job, we always have a contingency in place to cover the what ifs. And anytime you're doing a massive renovation, it is guaranteed you will come across something that you didn't plan because you couldn't see inside the walls or something was hidden. So that's what I always recommend. Do a contingency. I never do a contingency of less than 10%. If it's a known area with problems, or if it's an area that, you know, maybe definitely has asbestos or knob and tube or something like that, or if it's an older home, then we bump that up. You know, I've done contingencies as big as 25% if it was an area where we knew there were definitely foundation problems and definitely plumbing issues. So you just have to plan ahead and be careful. And never, ever operate best-case scenario when you're doing real estate investment or when you're looking to renovate. You want to operate under worst-case scenario, and then anything that's better than that is just equity in your pocket.
Okay, last question. What's the better twin film, Parent Trap or Dead Ringers?
I'd probably go with Parent Trap. I think I'd go with that. Or Twins, if you want to go with the whole Danny DeVito-Arnie combo. You know, that would be comical.
Property brother Jonathan Scott, the Scott Brothers House Party is happening September 12th at the Murat Theater. There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people, Zardoz has spoken. Go see a good movie, you deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!